Fiona, if I can invite you to join me here at the front. We thought we'd sit down because we have a bit of a conversation. So I hope you can just about make out Fiona's face. And there's plenty of time after the service, Fiona, for people to catch up with you, have a chat with you. But first of all, welcome to St Mary's.
Thank you.
Is the mic working, Lee?
Is the mic working?
There is a thumbs up. Thank you. That's brilliant. Fiona, it's so lovely to have you with us.
Thank you.
Some months ago, we contacted you and said, would you be willing to come for our St Mary's Festival and just be interviewed? And you said, yes, you would love to do that.
So I feel very honoured to be part of it. Thank you.
Right. Fiona, you live in Jazz Cross.
Yes.
I know you have friends in this church, so it's not like a completely strange place to you. Mm. That's really lovely. You have some special connections with Denham as well, as we will sort of unwrap a little bit later in our conversation. Just to set the scene, Fiona, you've got four grown-up children.
Yes.
Let me see whether I can get the names right. They're probably in the wrong order. Daniel, Julia, Antonia and Ben.
Right order, yes.
Right order. Excellent. And several of them are involved in music, in the arts and in the media. And that is not a surprise, because in a way they've taken after their parents.
Not parents, parent.
Well,
the only instrument I can play is the castanets, because I learnt to dance, you see.
There you go.
But nobody ever asks me.
And there is the arts connection, because you were a professional dancer at one point. And, of course, your husband of more than 30 years, Roy, he was a musician, an actor, and a presenter. We would love to know how you and Roy met.
Oh, my goodness. It's not the sort of thing you tell in a church, really.
Oh, goodness. It's a good start, isn't it?
Yeah.
Come on, be brave, Fiona.
I'll be brave.
Be strong and courageous.
Courageous, yes. No, I was a dancer and singer and, you know, in various shows. And I started off in the chorus, as you did. If you didn't get into a ballet company, which is what my ambition was, then you went into the chorus of pantomimes and summer seasons and things. And the first pantomime I did after I left school was at the Coventry Hippodrome. And Harry Secombe was top of the bill. Do you remember Harry?
Yes.
Ah, he was lovely. And Morecambe and Wise were second on the bill. And I got to know Eric really well and his wife Joan. And I did another show with them after that, in Morecambe. And maintained a friendship with them over the years. They knew I was a starving dancer, so occasionally they'd invite me to their home for weekends to they'd feed me up, and then they'd give me all the leftovers to take back to my little garret flat in London so I wouldn't starve for the rest of the week. They were really kind. It was on one of these occasions that we were sitting down watching television, and Roy happened to come on the television, and he'd recently made a name for himself, and I'd seen him at the London Palladium, and I just thought he was so talented. So in a stupid moment, I said to Eric, if ever you do a show with Roy Castle, can I come along? Because I'd love to meet him, because I think he's so brilliant. All right, love, was all I got. And I thought, well, that's never going to happen. And I got on with my life, and it was probably about 2 or 3 years later. I was in a show in London by that time, and Eric and Ernie were performing at the Palladium. And Eric phoned me at the theatre and said, hey, I'm doing a television show with Roy on Sunday. Would you like to come along? Because you don't work on a Sunday, do you? Oh, wow, yes. So off I went. And just before the show started, Eric took me into Roy's dressing room to introduce me. And I was so excited because I thought this was going to be the best moment of my life. Turned out to be the worst. Because Eric just said, Roy, this is Fiona, she's in love with you, and left. Ah! Left me blushing up to the roots of my then blonde hair, wishing I could die. I mean, what do you say after that? I am a very shy person by nature, and actually Roy was quite shy as well. So we just looked at each other and didn't say a word. But anyway, we all went out for a meal later, and it got better after that, and we started going out. But what I didn't find out until Roy knew me well enough was what Eric had said to him that day. He said, look, Roy, I've got this sad little case coming to see you. Do you think you could be nice to her? She's got braces on her teeth and pigtails, but try to be nice to her.
Unbelievable.
So that was how I met my husband.
With friends like these, who needs enemies?
But he felt so responsible for what he'd done that he used to ring us up after we got married about every month to make sure we were still being nice to each other.
Brilliant, brilliant. What a story. Well, Fiona, we're going to talk about your life and your faith, taking our cues actually from the story of Mary and the Magnificat that we've just heard. But before we do that, here is a little music clip. I'm not going to tell you anything about it, but I'm just going to watch the faces and see who recognizes it. So let's play the clip, Lee. I saw only about a handful of bobbing heads. Am I to take that the rest of the church have never heard this before? Who's heard it before? Oh, that's interesting, isn't it? The choir. Well done, choir. Dedication is What You Need was the title tune for which TV program? Of course it was. Record Breakers. Roy moderated that for, I think, 30 years or more. 22 years. And it was a massive program. It was a fun program. I've just watched some clips on YouTube because I was not in this country and too young for it. And this particular recording, if you thought there were a few duff notes, they were not from Roy. He didn't play the trumpet on that particular one. This was actually another record attempt which they managed to break for the largest live band ever. And there was something like 400 and X musicians all playing this piece together. And they were mostly young musicians. That's why there are a few tough notes. what a fun program. And of course, Roy really put a stamp on that program. Dedication is what you need. When we look at the person of Mary, what we see is utter dedication. That's what really strikes me when I look at her. When the angel Gabriel tells her she will be the mother of Jesus, the Son of God, her response famously is, "I am the servant of the Lord." Or in the wonderful words of the King James Version, "I am the Lord's handmaiden." What dedication. Fiona, over the years, you have shown a wonderful dedication to Jesus, a wonderful faith, a dedicated faith. Was that always the case throughout your life?
Well, I thought so right from the time I was a small child, because I went to church. I was born at the beginning of the war. It was the Second World War, in case anybody's looking at the wrinkles.
Don't worry, you can mention the war to me. It's all right.
Shall I leave now?
No. Carry on.
And in those days, I think we all believed in God and went to church and said our prayers, and we had Bible reading and a hymn and a prayer every morning at assembly at school and all of those things. It was all part of what we did. And I went to a boarding school from the age of 9 to train in ballet and theatre arts. It was a very strong emphasis on religion. So we went to chapel every morning. We had to chapel 3 times on a Sunday and so on. So it was all part of my inside, if you like, was part of me. But it was more of a ritual. I've been brought up to believe in a God who was always finger wagging, telling me if I didn't tick all the boxes and get enough brownie points, I wouldn't get to heaven, so I better behave. And it was all part of the discipline. And I thought that was it, really. And I suppose that was something that happened to me, that I just felt I wasn't good enough and I wasn't doing enough. And I was brought up always feeling that I wasn't as good as other people. And I'd look, after we were married and I had children, the people who were my friends, mums at the school gate and so on, I always felt that they did so much better than I did, and all the things that they did, I never did as well. And I just felt that I was rubbish. And my lovely husband, he was always such an encouragement to me and wanting the best for me. But I always came back to this place of total loss of any self-esteem whatsoever. And one day, I was at age 35 by this time, I went up to my bedroom after I'd taken the children to school, and I just got down on my knees and I cried out to God and I said, God, if you're there, you've got to help me, and you've got to help me now, because I've had it. I can't go on any longer. It was as simple as that. And I meant it. I didn't know where to turn, what to do. I wasn't even sure whether God was listening or whether he'd hear me or even if he was there. But I hadn't even got up off my knees before the phone rang. And when I answered the phone, the person who was at the other end was not somebody I would ever have expected to phone me. I'd met her a couple of times. I didn't even think she would probably have my phone number. But I did know that she was what she called a Christian. And she just said, Fiona, I don't know why I'm phoning you, but I've had you on my mind recently and I had this sudden urge to ring you. She said, I feel as if you need to talk. I don't know why and I don't know what you need to talk about, but would you like to come over and have a coffee with me and talk? Well, I had to recognize that as God's amazing way of answering that desperate cry for help. I went round to her house then and there, couldn't wait. I dumped Benjamin, our baby, into Roy's arms. He was about a year old, and I said, I'm going out, and I left. Poor guy, he told me later he thought I'd literally gone for good and left him holding the baby. But anyway, off I went. I think because I didn't know this woman very well, I felt confident to talk to her. I would never have told a family friend, a family member or a friend how I was feeling, because I didn't want to let the side down. I always tried to put a brave face on it and pretend that all was well. But inside, I was falling apart. So I offloaded on this lovely lady who was a very good listener, and she heard me out. And then she asked me probably the most challenging question I've ever been asked in my life. She simply said, you know, Fiona, you think you're a Christian because you go to church. But have you ever invited Jesus to come in and take over your life? Well, I said, no, I hadn't. Didn't realize you were supposed to. As far as I was aware, that wasn't in the Book of Common Prayer. I thought I'd done all the things by going to church, having the children christened, saying my prayers, and helping old ladies across the road. That's the way I'd been brought up. So, and she said, had I invited Jesus into my life? I didn't know what she was talking about. So she, when I said no, she said, well, don't you think it's about time you did? And so I just said yes, and I only said yes because I was afraid to say no. I didn't know what it would mean. I thought I might even have to try harder than ever to be good and tick more boxes and all the rest of it. But she then told me that she'd suffered from depression for many years and that taking that step had totally turned her life around. So I thought, well, if it's worked for her, it could work for me. So with her help, I took that step. She read me that wonderful Bible verse that I'm sure you all know. Look, I'm standing at the door and I'm constantly knocking. If anyone hears me calling him and opens the door, I will come in and enjoy fellowship with him and he with me. And I realized that Jesus had been knocking at the door of my heart for 35 years and I'd only paid him lip service. I'd never opened that door. I opened that door, and with her help, I prayed a very, very simple prayer that went something like this. Please, Jesus, forgive me for the mess I've made of my life up to now. I recognize the way I've tried to run my life hasn't worked. So you come in and take it over and see what you can do with the rest of it, okay? It was simple as that. And that was what I prayed, and that was what happened. All the tension, anxiety, and fear that I had lived with for most of my life just melted away. And in place of it came this incredible peace. It just fell all over me and right through me. I didn't know what to expect, but I certainly wasn't expecting that. And that peace has never left me. Because his peace is not dependent on our circumstances. It's easy to be peaceful when you're lying on a beach, isn't it? And you've got, like, haven't got a care in the world, and the sea's lapping at your feet and the sun's shining. It's different when your world is falling apart. But even at times when my world has fallen apart, I've known that peace. I invited Jesus to take over the rest of my life, and he's still doing that.
Wonderful. Thank you for sharing that very personal story with us. It's the peace that the Bible calls a peace that passes understanding.
It is beyond
understanding. And it became a reality in your life.
It's true.
The Magnificat begins with the wonderful words, "My soul magnifies the Lord. My soul lifts up the Lord." Words that have helped countless people to worship God, to praise God. Why is praise, and particularly praising God, so important in our lives?
Well, he calls us to do that for a start. But you know, it lifts the burden. Yeah. If you start, whenever I felt low, I start thanking God for all the things I have and for the things he's given me, and I praise God for that. And it's amazing how that will lift your spirit when you're feeling low, because you realize all the things that he's given us. I've spent quite a lot of time in various different countries in terrible conditions with a charity that I'm involved with that deals with children at risk in lots of different situations. And there isn't a night that I go to bed without praising God and thanking him that I've got a bed to sleep in. I've got electricity, I've got central heating, I've got food in the fridge. Doesn't take much to realize how much we have to be thankful for. Yeah.
Which actually leads us beautifully to the next bit we would like to talk about in the Magnificat, where Mary prays, "He has lifted up the humble." Fiona, you've written a range of books. One book of yours I've read with interest is Living Simply. And, you know, Mary was a young woman. She was most likely a teenager still. She was from a humble background, no special credentials. And she marvels that God should choose her out of all people. But also she knows that God has a track record of choosing simple, humble, unassuming people. People who think, a bit like you before you met Jesus, that, you know, you're nothing special and you wouldn't be up to the job. But she knows God has a track record of doing that. And that's why she prays. He lifts up the humble.
Amazing.
It's amazing, isn't it? And we think of so many people in the Bible, Moses and others, who have a similar sense when God calls them.
There's a lovely comment that I heard recently, which was, "Under the cross, no one is above another. All are equal."
Yeah.
And that just gave me so much courage.
Yeah.
And thinking, yes, we're all equal under the cross.
Yeah.
And we don't have to worry. We can be comfortable in our own skins, knowing that God has chosen us for a special purpose. We've all got different purposes and different opportunities, different areas of influence. And he calls us to be what he wants us to be. And I've always felt that so long as I'm where God wants me to be, doing what he wants me to do, that is my place of peace.
Yeah. And I think one of the things God has called you to do and to be is to actually engage with the least of the least through your charitable work, but also more closer to home. Your book, Living Simply, actually starts telling the story of when you visited your daughter. I think it was in Peru.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit more about that.
Well, Julia, my daughter, lived in Peru for 12 years, and she lived in this little shanty town, and it was a sort of concrete block, didn't even have a roof, proper roof, and it just had a staircase up to the top, and the rats used to come in through the night and other things as well. It was very, very basic, but she was working because her passion was to see the women in these shanty towns being able to feed their children. It was as basic as that. They hadn't any money, they hadn't any opportunities to work. So she taught them to make jewellery, and she set up this jewellery project for them in order to enable them to earn a living, to survive. And it was very, very basic. But when I first visited her, I went into this little place. I can't call it a house or a home. And all she had were orange boxes on their side for putting everything in, you know, whether it was food or clothes or whatever. And that was all that there was. And me, being a sort of indulgent mother, wanted to treat her. And I said, oh, darling, whilst I'm here, let's go to a shop and I'll buy you a wardrobe and some shelves and some cupboards and things for your kitchen area and so on. And she just looked at me and said, Mum, you just don't get the point. She said, I have everything I need. I was in trouble. But she was right. She had everything she needed. And there I was trying to indulge her with things I thought she would like or want. But there's such a difference between our wants and our needs, isn't there?
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing that impressed me, I spent quite a lot of time with her and watched. I went to her jewellery sessions with the people and spoke and talked to the women and the children and so on. The children had nothing, and yet they shared what they had with me. They were so full of fun and joy. And one time I went to this church where Julia was doing a jewellery day, and so they had the families were there and so on. And so I took a great big bag of pick and mix sweets for the children because I thought it would be a nice treat. Put it on the table. I left that evening after they'd been there all day, and there was still half a bag of those pick-and-mix sweets. Now, can you imagine if they'd been in England, they'd been, oh, you've only got, you've got more than I have, that's not fair. And they'd have gone in 5 seconds, wouldn't they?
It's fascinating.
But they just took one each at a time. And it's just, very different.
And what a reflection on where, in a sense, we are as a society. We have so much. And yet we hear it nearly daily on the news, how we're struggling, mental health issues, etc. Are we happier for it? And that sense of, I have enough, and God gives me everything I need, which you experienced in such a drastic way going out to see your daughter.
Yeah.
We're coming into land, Fiona, and it's so lovely to talk. We could talk on for hours, but we might just be here on our own if we keep going for an hour. So
okay, that's fine with me.
The good thing is you're not rushing away after this service.
No,
you're going to be around during our picnic time, so please use the opportunity to chat to Fiona. She'd love to chat with you. But just to land, let's come back to the theme of dedication that we started out with. Many of the people here will know that in the early 90s, your husband, Roy, got very ill with lung cancer. And you and Roy, you dedicated yourselves to this cause through the Roy Castle Lung Cancer Foundation. And I believe it was in 1994, shortly before his death, he did this great tour of hope across Britain, raising awareness about lung cancer. And during those last months, especially, of Roy's life, two special friends from Denham, I believe, were a great support to you. Tell us briefly about that.
Can you guess who they are? Sir John and Lady Mills. And they came to Euston Station when we started, and they came up on the train with us to Liverpool. And spent the first evening with us. We'd had a big show that they appeared on at the theatre there. And they were so kind and so generous and so loving. I knew them because I was at school with Juliet and Hayley, their two girls. I was the head of the dormitory.
Treat her with respect, will you?
But I knew Juliet and Hayley really well.
Lovely.
And so got to know John Mills through that.
Yeah.
And yes,
wonderful.
They were lovely.
Now, I think Roy never lost a sense of humour, even during his illness. I love when you told me that when he was ill, he changed the words of dedication is what you need into something slightly different.
Medication.
is what you need.
Yes.
And then, of course, the faith that you both lived by as a couple was the faith in which Roy died. And it was so moving when a couple of weeks ago he told me about his last days and that sense of being in God's presence. Can you just give me a flavour of that?
Yes. Roy wasn't afraid of dying. He wasn't just peaceful about dying. He was excited about dying, which was extraordinary to me. But in the last few days before he died, he started to have the most wonderful visions of heaven. And there was one time that he said, "I'm in this garden." He said, "I can't describe it to you because it's more beautiful than anything I've ever seen on earth." He said, "I thought I was a gardener, but this gardener's something else." He said, "Don't hang around, darling. You need to see this as well." And then he heard myriads of angels singing, "Because he lives, I can face tomorrow." Mm-hmm. And again, I couldn't hear it, but I was very aware of God's presence with us. And the very last time the pastor of Gold Hill Baptist Church, where we worship, came to give us communion at Roy's bedside, there were just the three of us in the room. And Roy suddenly pointed to the door and said, "Jesus is standing in the doorway. Can you see him?" We couldn't see him, but we were so aware of his presence. Mm. And Roy just had such peace about where he his eternal destination. It was amazing.
Beautiful. "Because he lives, I can face tomorrow." Mm. Or in the words of Mary, "His mercy is for those who fear him from generation to generation."
Amen.
Fiona, thank you. Can we show her our gratitude?